The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I'm your host, Soraya, as always, here on Where Did the Road Go? And tonight, I think we're going to have a very deep and interesting conversation with Mr. Gabriel Roberts. You there, Gabe?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. And where are you now? You're on the West Coast?
I'm on the West Coast. I'm currently looking out at the water from the peninsula out here in Washington, kind of across the water from Seattle. Quite
nice.
Lovely.
I bet. All right. Now... You have three published books, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And you've gone through a lot of spiritual changes in your life. Was your first book the one talking about that?
My first book was called Riding the Fine Line, and that was essentially a collection of kind of my earlier thoughts and essays and kind of a collection of... interesting pontifications, I guess. And then the second book is called Born Again to Rebirth, and that was about growing up in and kind of exiling from evangelical Christianity and kind of go on the philosophical progression out of it rather than, you know, the Dawkins style of no, because science. This is more kind of like the heartfelt sequential thought approach, mm-hmm. I guess.
And so you want to tell people a little bit about how you were raised and how you got into evangelical Christianity?
Sure. You know, it's very common for people to grow up in some version of Christianity. Around the world, there are over 41,000 different sects of Christianity, all of which are in different sects because they think that theirs is the right one. Mine was no different. I grew up in Assemblies of God household, kind of, and it was interesting because my dad grew up Mormon and my mom grew up Lutheran, and somehow between the two of them, they decided to be Pentecostals. So I grew up watching Jimmy Swaggart and actually, you know, the preacher who got caught with all the hookers and stuff and apologized to God on TV and stuff.
Right.
I would emulate him. Not with the hookers, but with the whole his preaching style, and I was very excited about God. When I think of it this way, I think of it like when you tell an innocent child something, they believe you. They have no reason to question you, and they don't really have the wherewithal to go through, you know, a logical sequence of thoughts to see if they're coming to the right conclusions. They just simply believe you, and I was told that the world was a certain way, and that's what I believed. And that belief didn't really change until I was about 27 years old, and I, you know, had just graduated from Seattle Bible College with a degree in theology. And you know, up until that point, I was an evangelical Pentecostal Christian who was in many ways all for it. So that's kind of how I grew up.
And how young were you when you had really gotten into this, when it really got a hold on you?
Oh, well, by the time I was, you know, 6 or 7 years old, I was on the streets of Salt Lake City handing out tracts to Mormon kids, telling them why Mormonism was of the devil and why Christianity was the real way. I think by the time I was 8, I had done my first conversion in the sandbox. So I was pretty hardcore. From the get-go.
And what changed this? What changed your outlook on stuff?
You know, there are, of course, a myriad of factors that come along as life progresses. But the biggest to me was the disparity between the way that my heart felt and the way that the written word in the Bible described God in kind of a paradoxical fashion. God is perfect, and God is amazing, and all of these things, and yet God makes a situation that's kind of doomed to failure. You know, if you do the most rudimentary crunching of numbers with, if one is to believe in the sin and salvation scenario, for instance, if people are going to hell, and God has made it so that if you don't accept him, you go to hell, just by basic numbers, far less than 10% of all people who have ever lived will go to heaven. That means that 90% are going to hell. And it's hard for me to believe that just from that scenario, that's the best possible plan. It doesn't sound like good planning for a business. If you went to Bank of America and you're like, well, we're going to have 90% of our stuff fail, but that 10% is going to be really great. They wouldn't give you a loan. So if, in many ways, I suppose this is the Bank of America proof text. But there's just things like, one of the biggest moments was when my son was born. I looked over him with and the greatest outpouring and outflow of love that I had ever experienced, looking at this tiny little guy. And I thought to myself, would I ever set him on fire if he did something wrong or if he disobeyed me? Would I ever think I was too good for him or too pure and holy for him to set him on fire? And I didn't have to think very long. I thought, no, not at all. Right. And that's really the moment that it stopped making sense for me, because God in the monotheistic sense is supposed to be our father. And if I, being a human father, full of all the failings that every human has, can have a level of compassion and understanding and love that is so deep that I would never do something like this to my child, even temporarily, then how could an eternal father cause an eternal fire to even be a possibility? So in that sense, that was all I really needed. But like so many things, we get little fault lines and little cracks in the way that we see the world. And so those things didn't really come into fruition for a really long time, and I had an internal struggle. And I just kept that to myself. And we often do that. And I needed more, because my entire life was built on that. And when you take away something that everything is built upon, it has disastrous effects. There's no other way around it.
Yeah, yeah. It's and the thing is, people don't always understand that you can only see the world based on your world experience, based on what you know and your personal experience. Because sometimes people will be like, "Well, how can people believe that?" Well, if they've never seen it from any other perspective or had any other, you know, life experience that shows them differently, that makes them question it, it's pretty easy.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
and go on. That's, you bring up exactly what gnosis is kind of that firsthand experience, and that's kind of what led me from my book, Born Again to Rebirth, to the quest for gnosis, which is essentially me going out and asking 20 other people, hey, what about this spiritual path? Is there anything to it? You know, what about the mind sciences? What about magic? What about psychedelics? What about all these things? Because these are all contributing factors. And so that's kind of how the progression has come along, because really anybody who's read Born Again to Rebirth is going to be at the end of the book be like, okay, well, that's great. But so what do I do now that I'm totally, you know, taking this gigantic, you know, bulldozer to my life. Where do I go now? And so I kind of give people 20 different directions that they could go that I think would be positive and good. And that's why I included the people that I did in the quest for gnosis.
And who do you have in the book?
I have conversations with Graham Hancock, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Simon G. Powell, Dr. Lou Graham, Hamilton Morris, Crystal Cole, Dr. Rick Strassman, Chad McCracken, Dr. Aaron Cheek, Dr. David Metcalf, Anthony Peake, my friend Odd Edges, Daniele Borelli, Peter J. Carroll, Nick Margerison, Matt Staggs, Maja Diao, Abby Martin, Jeremy Johnson, Cameron Wilshire, and Randall Carlson. these are all experts in their particular fields, and they all have a very unique take on things. These are people who are television celebrities, people who are scientists and things like that, and other people who are religious scholars and religious leaders. And, so it was very interesting to bring this broad cross-section of individuals around. And not all of them believe in kind of spirituality in any of its sense, as it were. Some of them are actual, you know, scientific materialists, mechanists,
right,
reductionists.
So you want, you wanted to get a cross-section without any kind of real agenda behind it.
Well, the only real agenda that I had behind it was to say that there is a unifying factor in ecstatic states. Our ecstatic states that we experience, for instance, I'll give a personal example. When I was in, as a Pentecostal, we would play lots of lively music, and you would feel a sense of unity and kind of a euphoric sense that something good was going on, and we called that the Spirit of God. But I went to a Ziggy Marley concert and was smoking weed with a bunch of people, and I felt the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait a second, I was told that this wasn't of God, but this feels the same. This feels amazing. This sense of unity and commonality and purpose and love is the same. And then I realized that, you know, in my studies, that this is a universal experience, and that there are a myriad of ways to kind of gain that spiritual ecstasy, and it doesn't require a religious dogma whatsoever. And that's why people like Hamilton Morris, who writes for Harper's and for Vice, he's a materialist, but he talks about these spectacular states, and he says why, you know, whether or not these experiences are all inside of our own brain or are outside or some mixture doesn't matter. It's the power of the experience, the transformative experience, that is the most important. And really, ultimately, people seeking a religious or a spiritual path are looking for a way to fix something, you know, to attain something that isn't there before or that is imperfect, to kind of work on yourself, to improve yourself and to improve the world around you. And so if we can do that without the bonds of dogma that are lines of separation for us, then we can find ourselves in a position where we are not kind of cloistered away, we're not hidden, but we're actually capable of seeing every perspective and glean something from that. And it's not about muddling the truth that we have. It's about broadening and strengthening those truths that are universal. So, I don't know. I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, it's also, what you're defining is kind of the difference between spirituality and religion. And a lot of people don't understand that there is a difference, that you can be spiritual without being religious. You can be religious without being spiritual. They are two very different things.
Right. Yes, you definitely can have that. I mean, and sometimes this is a matter of semantics. It's a play on words. For instance, when I was a Christian, I would say, oh, no, Christianity is not religion. It's a relationship with God. And that's just kind of a linguistic change. You know, that's just rhetoric, basically. But really what it is we're all humans. We all have the same feelings. We all want love. We all want to have a connection. We all want to have a full belly and a warm place to sleep at night. We all have the same desires. And we also have the same capabilities. We all have that ability to connect with the divine. And there are people who have spent all of their lives in a lineage of thousands of years who, that's all that they've done is work towards connecting with the divine. And to say one over the other is rather difficult. I think that there are things that are more expedient than others, but each path, even if I don't agree with the totality of the idea, each path has something to contribute to the story and to the mix. And that's what's so beautiful about the human experience is the diversity that we see.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, definitely. And diversity is incredibly important because not everything's going to appeal to everybody. Sometimes you need to have something that fits your perspective well. So what do you think the benefits and pitfalls of traditional religion are?
You know, the primary benefit of a religious system is to provide a structure for anybody. For instance, although I may have stepped away from the dogma of Christianity, you know, many, if not most, of the teachings of Christ ring true on a foundational level with many religions and many beliefs. So there is a foundational thing, you know, the golden rule, the caring for others more than just being selfish all the time. Having a devotion and or an openness to the divine or to the world outside that can come to us and show us something new. The pitfalls are war, justified murder, justified rape, justified torture. This is still going on, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's awful. And people use kind of a fake God in whatever way to suit whatever, you know, whatever their purpose is. And the reality is that even within every individual religion, you get down to the individual person. And even if you and I saw things exactly the same way, at least in speech, and we did the same things, our perspective on that wouldn't be the same because I didn't grow up like you did.
Right.
We had different parents, we had different friends, we had different good and bad experiences. So really, the religious path tries to homogenize things and put it into a nice tidy box. But humanity doesn't fit in a nice tidy box. The only way you do fit it into a nice tidy box is when you smash it together with a hammer, with war and all of these other things. So these controls are like corrals, and they become a system of subjugation. And so that's a massive problem. And I do believe that until we can get past that, we're going to continue to see war. We're going to continue to see really bad ideas, you know, slapping God's name on it and saying, oh, well, this is a good idea because God said so. And until we get rid of that kind of illogical approach, we're not going to get to real spirituality. And, you know, personally, I embrace God. But my definition of God versus a monotheist's definition of God is extremely different. And so I think it's just important to realize that those pitfalls are huge pitfalls. So we have to be able to find a way around that. And so deconstructing those things and taking kind of the Bruce Lee approach, as Daniele Bolelli would say, if I may, for just 1 second, describe. Bruce Lee took all of the kung fu systems that were around that he had mastered, and he took away all of the moves that were ornamental, that had no purpose. And if one move from one style was better than all other moves in the other style, then he would have it be only that way. So what he did was he threw away what didn't work, and he kept the stuff that did work, and then he refined those things. And I think that this approach is the ideal approach to kind of a new hybrid system, a loosely knit system in which we can use the stuff that traditionally we know works.
Well, I think part of the problem, too, is when you say the word God, especially in Western culture, people immediately think Christian, Judaic-type God.
Right.
You know, it's by default.
Right, and that's incorrect. Of course, but that is the natural assumption. That's our language tells us that that's the case. So we have to, we can't really fault people for that. And that's why, you know, any theological conversation requires time, because you have to be able to sit down and define your terms before you get going. Otherwise, you'll get confused. You know, it's such a mess, really.
And the other thing, when it comes to, like, war and religion and stuff, a lot of the stuff that is masqueraded as religious really isn't. I mean, when we look at what's going on in the Middle East, how much of it's really religious and how much of it is the West wanting those resources and the East, you know, and the Middle East defending themselves from invasion, really.
Right, because you see, it's for every person that I've ever met who is genuinely earnest in their search for contact with the divine and love and compassion, they will not be advocating murder of another human being. Right. They just won't. That's my opinion. I haven't seen anybody who's contrary. And normally those people, they show their true colors if that's the case. So then what do you have left? You have people who don't know their own books, don't practice their own beliefs, or are along for the ride, or are the ones in control conveniently telling people what to do. For instance, when I was an evangelical Christian, George Bush II was in office and 9/11 happened, and I saw him, at that time, I saw him as a Christian president of a Christian nation telling us basically the will of God.
Right.
And he used terms, or his speechwriters used terms that kept every Christian manipulable for that purpose. And so when he said they are evildoers and we are, you know, the extended righteous hand of God, well then that justified anything. That justified virtually anything that was done. But, you know, when you do that, you can tell people what to do. Oh, God said so it must be okay. So
yeah,
that's how it is.
and it's very carefully planned out. It's not like it's an accident. They knew exactly what they were doing, who they were appealing to, and what the end result was going to be.
Yes, precisely.
That's a great example. I know someone who became kind of a militant atheist because of 9/11, and you know, and I look at it and I'm like, okay, let's for the sake of argument say that the official story is true because he believes that story. It still wasn't about religion. They didn't fly planes into the buildings because of religion. If anything, they flew them into the building because we kept bombing their women and children and innocent people, and were retaliating. They had said they were going to retaliate over and over. The more we did it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Russell Brand gets a lot of flack that he was on Fox News, and he was talking about how when you drop a bomb on these people, it's not a bomb, it's a terrorist creator. For every bomb you drop, it creates 100 new terrorists.
Right.
And because you can be nice, but if you just as a regular person are pushed and your family is threatened and things like that, a very kind, otherwise normal, peaceable man will do things he would never dream of doing. But in rage, in defiance, in defense, he'll do awful things. And the people that, you know, seem to be running the show, they know that.
Yeah.
You know, we use this against each other. We have to stop thinking in black and white terms because we don't live in a black and white world. This is why when people go to court, you have lawyers discussing all of the nuances of a situation, because things may seem a particular way from the get-go, but they may not have actually been that way once all the details are concerned. So when we're throwing bombs at people, it's just awful. And I don't think that anyone with a, you know, an active conscience would be wanting to advocate murder of children and things like that. And I just think it's something we have to get past. And for anyone who's out there listening and, you know, thinks that what I'm saying is wrong, I would just say, hey, think about it. I mean, are you wanting to live a life of compassion? If you know, these people that were bombing were your next door neighbors, would you still want to bomb them? If they went to school with your kids, if they hung out and played together, would you still want to bomb them because of an ideological difference? No, we're talking about borders and people having control over money and resources. And, you know, it has nothing to do with religion in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. And, when you know, one of the analogies I try to make to people is that if China decided, well, they're going to protect the oil supply because we owe them so much money, so they move troops into Texas. And then they start, you know, setting up checkpoints and occasionally killing people that they think might be a threat, people in Texas and the rest of the country would band together to fight back, and they would do so, you know, without the government's help, for instance, as terrorists to the Chinese. It would be, we'd be doing the same thing, and they would probably marshal under the flag of Christianity, not because it was a religious war, but simply because that's the dominant religion in the area, and it's something that they can all focus on and kind of, you know, we're right here, let's, you know, this is God's will, et cetera, et cetera, but it really doesn't have anything to do with religion.
Yeah.
And certainly, exactly. And certainly nothing to do with spirituality in the slightest.
Right. Exactly.
Because I'll hear, especially hear from atheists who will say, well, I don't understand how someone can be spiritual and not religious. But spirituality, to me, is something that doesn't necessarily have borders. It doesn't have a dogma to it. It's, well, as the title of your book is, it's a sort of gnosis, a sense of what's really out there. And religion,
exactly.
And religion can be someone just literally following the book. An odd example would be what Anton LaVey did. I mean, Anton LaVey was a police officer down south and saw these pious people going to church on Sunday and then committing crimes all week long and then going to church on Sunday. Well, they're obviously not spiritual people if they're doing this.
Right.
And that inspired him to do the whole satanic Bible thing and kind of, you know, rebel against that hypocrisy that he was seeing in his day-to-day life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. I actually did an interview with Dr. Michael Latino, who ended up beginning the Temple of Set.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to talk with him after watching and reading dozens of hours of just inflammatory material against him, and then speaking with him was just very simple, very easy, very clear.
Right.
So what we assume about other people and what the reality is, again, are two very different things. You know, spiritual people, for instance, I would say that Peter J. Carroll, for instance, who's in my book, he's the founder of a variation of modern magical tradition called chaos magic. All it basically means, it's very close in some ways to Buddhism, but basically the universe is built upon chaos, and it seems to come together and work in patterns over time, mathematically speaking. And so, but he talks about different methods and techniques of achieving the ends that you desire, but he all does this from a perspective of atheism. So he has a spiritual practice. He goes, he even has routines and things that he operates on. But it's all from the understanding that his brain can be changed, that his own internal wiring can be tinkered with. And any good magician will tell you that really all magic is you kind of tinkering with your own head. And it's already happening. If you're a religious person out there listening, your mind has already been tinkered with, and you just decided that you liked it that way. But you can change. You can say tomorrow, you could right now be a guy who owns 20 guns and eats red meat every day and drives a huge pickup truck and you whatever, right? And then tomorrow you can say, I'm going to be a vegetarian today. And I'm going to pet every dog that I see, and I'm not going to squash a fly. I'm going to be somebody completely different today, and only for today. And you could totally do that. And that's all that really is happening, is we develop these habits in our life, and then we begin to believe that they must be real because they're habits that we follow. But we can change any aspect of ourselves anytime that we decide to. So, spiritually speaking, this is what appeals to me, and this is why I had Peter J. Carroll in there, because here's a man who's an atheist, and yet he spends all of his time working on that spiritual path of understanding self, and that's a really key core aspect of any tradition, is the disillusion of self. It's easy in Christianity, because in Christianity it says, you are a slave to Christ, so you don't have a will. That's like ego disillusion, right? That's the disillusion of self. And that's exactly the same thing, but it's done from the subjugation aspect of, like, you have no choice in the matter. And the other traditions say you do have a choice in the matter. You can decide what it is that you are a slave to or not a slave to. So that's pretty strong. That's pretty strong spirituality, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the aspects that Peter J. Carroll would approach it from.
Yeah, yeah. The and atheism is interesting in itself too, because the variety of people who call themselves atheists to me is fascinating. Like, you have the very militant, reductionist, materialistic atheist who doesn't believe in anything outside of the self, believes that, you know, even, you know, something like psychic abilities, even when there are scientific tests to prove it, they're not going to believe it because the mainstream doesn't accept it, and everything has to be broken down and can't exist outside the brain, et cetera, et cetera. But then you have the school of atheism who may not believe in God, but they may have some spiritual leanings, some spiritual beliefs. They may believe that even that there's something more out there, they just don't necessarily believe in God.
Right.
And a lot of them also seem to lean a little more toward Buddhism.
Right. And it's funny you should mention that, because just in my own life, you know, I went through a breakup a couple of weeks ago, and it was really hard. And when I went through that breakup, I just had to let go of everything. And the thing about Buddhism is, it's about letting go of everything. And so I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it was amazing, because you know, all the book really is saying is, it's telling you, actually sit there and you talk to the dead person and you say, I know you're confused right now, but here's what to do and what not to do. And essentially, the spirit can hear you, and it goes and does the right thing that it's supposed to do, as opposed to the wrong thing. But one of the descriptions it gives is, it says, when you see your loved ones weeping and crying out for you, you're right there with them, and you try to talk to them, and they can't hear you, and it may cause you to despair. Stop desiring to be with them. Your time with them is over. So you have to let go. Otherwise, you will turn into a ghost of sorts,
right,
and you will be stuck there, and you won't be able to move on. And when I read that, all I was thinking about was my relationship with this woman, and how I had to look at it from that perspective, letting go, because I can't move on until I do, and neither can they. And so this is why In a lot of Buddhist and Hindu traditions, there's a lot of and Western traditions as well, there is this idea of the kind of marriage of Eros and Thanatos, of sex and death. And I don't mean it in the crass manner. I mean, in what do we think about? You know, sex is procreation. That is the giving of life. And then death is the other end of the spectrum. So those two things are major factors in our life. We live in fear of death. We live with a desire for sex. We are somewhere in between. And so that approach and the Buddhist perspective is interesting, because they don't really touch on God, per se. That's not even what it's about. It's kind of like, don't distract yourself with God. Just, you know, work on your own stuff.
Right.
You know, that's like, you know, you can only deal with what you have here and now. And yes, that might be part of the formula, but it's kind of that relevant to the individual thing. And at least from my own experience and perspectives and psychedelic experiences, I've realized that my interconnectedness with everything and everyone else is much more important, and that's my connection to God. Every moment that I live and breathe, and I talk with people like yourself and everyone that I meet, have something to tell me if I'm willing to listen. Isn't that what listening to God should be like? To observe nature and to see the message that's being said to us, to actually listen to the person that we're talking to see the pain on someone's face and be able to read it like you're reading a newspaper, and be able to interact with them in a way that is fulfilling and causes growth and healing. I think that's way more important than having some distant, you know, bearded person in the sky who's judging us if we masturbate or if we steal a cookie from a cookie jar. I think it's much better if we think of it as our interaction with everyone is our interaction with God. And there's even a Western place for that. You know, there are verses in the Bible that talk about how we entertain angels and we're unaware of it, right?
Right.
The idea is, watch out, you're being watched everywhere. But instead, if you see that as everyone and everything that you talk to has some divinity to it, then everything becomes miraculous. Everything becomes beautiful.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way I try to approach things. It doesn't always work that way, but...
All right, well, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Gabriel Roberts.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we've been talking with Gabriel Roberts about a whole host of things, and his latest book is entitled The Quest for Gnosis. Do you have a simple definition for gnosis?
There are two modern definitions for gnosis. The first is the traditional Greek understanding, and that essentially means experiential understanding of a mystical nature. So, let's put it like this. You may read a book about pizza. You may talk to someone who's eaten pizza. You may see pictures of pizza. You may even have had individual ingredients. But until you have tasted pizza, you don't know about pizza. And it doesn't mean you know everything about pizza. It just means that you have a point of reference.
Right.
Gnosis is your point of reference. And I would say that in the religious context or the spiritual context, religion is like someone else telling you about the pizza that they ate. Spirituality is you tasting the pizza yourself, and gnosis is tasting the pizza. The other version is a magical term in Western magic, which is essentially just the Western term for what in the East they refer to as samadhi, which is a state of non-mind. And I don't mean you don't think or anything like that. It is clearing the space so that you can do a spiritual working, essentially. And this is the time that you have contact with the divine, a connection where you can hear clearly the message. You know, in the Western biblical sense, you know, there are verses like, "Be still and know that I am God." That stillness is the same kind of stillness being discussed in a Buddhist or in a Hindu context. So what it really means is that we're getting all the clutter out from our mind. And, you know, this is a huge challenge for me because my mind is always running and rushing. And one of my biggest personal practices right now is to work on slowing down to be here now, so to speak, and just clear all those things up. So the two definitions are experiential knowledge of a mystical nature, and the other one is the ecstatic state itself, in which you clear everything out and make room for contact with the divine.
And I think our culture nowadays is the antithesis of that, because, you know, everything has to be rushed. You need this, you need that. It's all about, you know, desiring new things in this consumerist sort of environment, and it's always pushing you, you know, into debt, into, you know, worrying about the future and having to rush and get as much done as possible, as quick as possible, which is, you know, obviously the mirror opposite of moving toward any kind of gnosis or quiet of mind.
Right, exactly. And I'm just like everyone else in that regard. I catch myself being that way and doing that. And what I'm trying to do is change my nature. And I believe that it's possible. So I'm working on that. And I think that this is a great moment to talk about the distinction between what a disciplined practice versus singular experiences. there's a big difference. Just because you had a big spiritual experience once is not the same as you having a practice that gives you discipline. And this is the part, I'm talking just as much to myself as I would be to anyone else. You know, I've had a lot of psychedelic experiences that were fantastic, that were otherworldly, where it was just a phenomenal, life-changing, I will never be the same kind of experience. The kind of experience that I had longed for 27 years as a Christian and didn't receive until many years later in a psychedelic context. But now I'm past that stage, and now I'm in a place where I have to be disciplined, and I have to really care about my personal growth and not just talk about it. And again, this has a biblical context as well. You know, there's a verse that says, "Be doers of the word and not hearers only." Right? Practice what you preach. So this is it. The practice, the daily practice, the going through every day and working on yourself and growing. And, what's the fruit of that? Well, the fruit is the same. Whatever religious tradition or spiritual tradition you come from, it still goes to love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, self-control, all of those things. Those are the fruit of the right work in that sense.
And it seems like Aleister Crowley was one of the first to try and bring all these different magical practices together, too, in that type of a way. Like the sort of the Bruce Lee style, to take the stuff that works and throw out the stuff that didn't. But he always said that, I'm paraphrasing here the quote, but something like, "God is a mountain, and seen from different sides, named by different people, with different paths to the top, but it's still the same mountain."
Yes, I would agree. I would add that I think that Helena Blavatsky was the real, genuine precursor to that.
True,
But both of them had very powerful things to say and to add to the mix. You know, just like anyone, Crowley had his own foibles and things like that, and he was a showman. He knew how to get things going, so to speak.
Yes.
And so, but I think that there was a method to his madness, because I think, well, if you go to the word occult, for instance, occult means covered. Something is occulted, it's covered.
Right.
Why is it covered? Well, it's hidden. Does that mean it's spooky? Not necessarily. But you wouldn't show, you wouldn't try to teach trigonometry to a kindergartner. So you've occulted trigonometry, you know, in that sense. They're not ready for it. They may never be ready for it. When they are, you'll know, and then it can be revealed layer by layer. And this is why systems of magic and other things like that go in a sequential nature, because you don't give away something that's of high value. You don't give a Formula One car to a teenager who just got their license.
Right.
There's a sequence of events and learnings and unlearnings that need to occur. And so I think that that's why the occult will always remain, to a greater or lesser degree, up to a certain percentage of society, really understanding it, not just using it as a fetishized style or things like that. But for those who are genuinely looking to have understanding in it, it's, again, it all comes back to the same things, same experience. We're all going to the same divine source, the same mountain, as you were talking about. It's funny, the only person that I've ever talked to has kind of used that mountain reference. But I talk about kind of our own life path as a bunch of rivers trickling down from a mountain. And one river says to another river, "No, you're doing it wrong. The way to the ocean is the way I'm going." And the other one goes real quick, but it goes really fast and really hard. And the other one goes really slow and meanders for hundreds and hundreds of miles, but they all go back to the same source.
Right.
And, I like that. I've never heard that Crowley quote before. It's pretty great.
No, I'm hoping I'm attributing right. I'm pretty sure it was Crowley. It's been a while since I've read his stuff. So the other thing when it comes to things like magic and occult is you're talking about changing the way we think and you know the way we deal with things and changing ourselves, but there may also be sort of an unconscious level to that. Like the ritual affects something deeper down in us that actually is part of what really affects the reality around us.
Well, yes, and that's why certain practices are attuned to that sort of thing. There's a part of us which is more and more becoming recognized in the scientific community, but Jung talked a lot about our shadow self,
right,
kind of coming from a primordial source. And now we've seen that encoded in our DNA is the memory of our ancestors. And how you know, the traditional joke, how far does the rabbit hole go, you know, how far? But if we think about having all of human history encoded in our DNA, that means all of the violence and all the strangeness, but also all of the goodness and all of that is all encoded in there. But there's a massive part of human history, it's much bigger than the linguistic part, that was pictorial, that was only based on images. And that part of us is extremely powerful. And really what magicians do in a modern sense is they take what the shamans have been doing for tens of thousands of years, as evidenced by the cave paintings that we've found in France and Germany and all over the world, we can see that people have been using images. So one of the classic things that you can see, you can find a homogenized version of this in books like The Secret, but when for instance, you draw a picture of something that you want or something that you would like to do, and you focus upon that picture, the primordial aspect of yourself kind of goes to work on it. And you know, I'm not here to say whether or not that's something that everybody should do, but it is something that has occurred for tens of thousands of years of human history, and it predates all modern religions as we see them. So it's a very powerful thing, and that is the reason why ritual of sorts is important. It creates a space in which we say this is set apart from the rest of our regular, banal, everyday life. We set this apart as something special where we do something with intention. And I think that anybody from any religious background can understand the importance of that and relate to that, because that's why you take off your shoes when you go into certain holy places. That's why you ring a bell before you do certain practices. All of these things are variations, again, of our human experience. Our bodies and our minds work in a certain way, and we know how to do that. So if we bring all those things together, that's when we can maximize our learning. And a magician is kind of a person who mixes all of those things, kind of like a chef would, to make up their own kind of new dish, so to speak.
All right. From your view right now, what would you say reality is?
Reality is a very slippery devil. In traditional Gnostic beliefs, reality was just like it was described in the film The Matrix.
Right.
It is something that's been pulled over our eyes to blind us from the truth that we're slaves. In traditional Gnosticism, the entire Old Testament is flipped on its head, and the New Testament as well. And essentially, according to this traditional Christian belief that was highly prominent before 325 AD, says that the God of the Bible is an enslaving vampire, basically, who sucks off of our energy either by our fear or by our worship. So either way, it's feeding off of us, right? And that the material world was to be shunned and shooed away because it's an illusion. And the interesting thing about that is, if you go to Eastern thought, then they say, this is Maya. The world is Maya. It is an illusion. So in both of those contexts, you have this thing that says, this isn't real, or it's not the only real that there is. And now what we find in our understanding of quantum physics, and the more we learn, the weirder it gets. You know, there's the idea that life is a computer program, so on and so forth. What I believe about all of that, though, is that we do have a purpose, and we do have a reason, and our purpose and our reason is to make use of this time, which is precious. There's a reason why we taste the just fantastic flavor of a perfectly ripe peach, or smell a flower, or feel the kiss from someone who loves us, or the exhilaration of climbing a mountain, or, you know, flying down the road on a motorcycle. All of those things are fantastic. And I think that the hardships that we face in life are kind of like, not tests per se, but they're just refinements. And some of those things can be really awful, really painful, and we can't fully understand it. And yet, if we realize the transitive nature of life itself, nothing is permanent. We're not even the same people that we were a year ago. We look in the mirror and we say, where did this gray hair come from? What happened when my finger got cut off when I, you know, was messing with the lawnmower? All of these things change us. And even I was thinking about the way that we see celebrities. Like, when I was a kid, Burt Reynolds was, you know, big and famous and Smokey and the Bandit and stuff like that, right?
Right.
Well, is Burt Reynolds the same Burt Reynolds that he was back then? He doesn't look the same. He doesn't sound the same. Well, what about all those famous people that are dead now? You know, Christie Brinkley doesn't look like the Christie Brinkley that I remember her as. So there's an image of Christie Brinkley that isn't the reality of who Christie Brinkley is. In fact, all of those realities that I think are real are all things that I kind of constructed out of my experiences. So I have my own individual reality tunnel, as the writer Robert Anton Wilson described it. We all have a reality tunnel. So there is a consensus reality. We're all on the same playing field. We're not quite sure why, but we know that we're here and we're playing, and most of us want to do a good job, but a lot of us have no idea. And the only way to have a better idea is to continue to work on ourselves, to continue to try to improve the way that we treat other people, the way that we see the world, to stop and observe, smell the roses, and so on and so forth, and then be able to let go of it all at the same time. It's a big challenge. I mean, I think it's pretty hard, but I think it's worth doing, and I want to see this thing through to the end.
Okay, all right. And what about consciousness? How would you define your view of consciousness at the moment?
I think that consciousness at its core is a level of awareness. It is not a singular place. It is almost a scale of sorts. And again, it's a matter of perspective. The more that we study plants, the more we realize that, for instance, there was a study that just came out that I heard about this week, where they can tell that plants know when they're being chewed on by insects, because there's a particular pheromone or something that only is released that happens when an insect is chewing on them. And in these tests, they'll apply this pheromone or whatever, and even when the plants aren't being chewed, then they'll have a reaction. So plants, and in fact, there was a Swiss study, a manifesto that came out a couple of years back that said basically it's inhumane to chop down plants unless you absolutely have to. So if you're cutting them down for food, but if you're just running through the forest hacking things, you are basically injuring innocent things. So this level of consciousness is highly subjective. Conscious compared to what? Are you only conscious because I can hear you scream if I injure you? What is that, basically? So, again, we come to a very relativistic sense, and that's not very satisfactory for people who want to feel like they have their world nicely, tightly sealed in a nutshell, and everything's perfect. The reality is nothing is stable. You're not the same person you were before. And in the sense of consciousness, we have this gift in which we can adjust and increase our consciousness, and that's simply by stopping and being more aware of the present. The past is a memory, but it's also kind of manufactured. We pick and choose what we remember, and the future is something we haven't really experienced yet, and so we live in either hope or fear. But all of those things are even imaginations, right? Mm-hmm. So all we have right now to be conscious, to increase our consciousness, is to increase our awareness. And this is why when people take psychedelics or they meditate and they feel their consciousness increasing, that's because their awareness is increasing. They're simply observing more than they were previously observing. And with more observation comes more perspective, and with more perspective comes higher levels of compassion.
The problem, too, is that a lot of people are not that self-aware. I mean, you don't know if you're not self-aware. Most people, I'm sure, think they are, but when you see people, basically, what did Robert Anton Wilson call it? The robot in control. Where,
yeah,
you know, they're just doing things, but they're not thinking about what they're doing. They're just doing it, you know, it's just learned habitual behavior that just goes.
Right. And to a certain degree, people can't be blamed, and at the same time, people are totally responsible for themselves.
Well,
this is why the law works. People are responsible for themselves.
Right. I think it's a necessary thing. We need that robot because we can't micromanage everything in our world. But there are people who let more and more of that robot take over and just become more and more oblivious to the world around them. And they're the ones that would have the hardest time changing, hardest time letting go of things because there's just nothing. They're not even aware they're doing it.
Right. And what is that based out of? They want to stay comfortable. And really all comfort is the avoidance of suffering. And then you come back to Buddhism again. You know, the avoidance of suffering, right? Desire begets suffering. Eliminate desire and you eliminate suffering. It's, you know, we have the thing, we're listening, you know, to our, we're on our iPhone that came out last year and a new iPhone comes out. Well, now our iPhone isn't good enough anymore. What is that? Is it really, is that appeal to novelty that great? That it, because it's new, it must be better? No, probably not. Not in any major change, but we, now that we know it happens, we want it. You know, I was a coffee salesman for years and years, and anytime I had like five different kinds of coffee in my catalog, and I would never talk about the fifth one. I always talk about the four. And people would see in the catalog the fifth one and be like, well, what's this one? Oh, no, that one's not for you. Well, why is that not for me? It's a natural propensity we have to want the new thing. And this is that kind of consumption. And we have to kind of quiet that monster down somehow, but it's hard.
Well, the thing, too, is that the people who are selling these things are so good at getting into people's heads, so good with using psychology to make you feel that you need those things. I mean, it's an art form on their part at this point. They got it down. They know how to draw people in.
Well, if you want to learn about what black magic is, all you have to do is take a marketing class.
Fair enough. Of course, you also got the other end of the spectrum, the people who don't ever want anything new. Everything has to be the same old, nothing can change type of thing.
Right, and again, that's a delusion because everything is changing. Their fingernails grow, their hair grows, our bodies fall apart. We dissolve into the earth eventually. Like, all of these things, nothing is staying the same. You can build a house, and if you stand there and watch long enough, if you could stand there and watch for 200 years, you would watch the thing dissolve.
Right.
It's totally going away. Even stones melt over thousands and thousands of years. So all of this stuff will be gone. The earth one day, many, you know, hopefully a really long time from now, will be totally annihilated, will be totally gone.
Sure.
And nothing is standing still. And when we look on the molecular level, we can see that literally. And when you get into a meditative state or a psychedelic state, you also see that. Everything's always bouncing around. You're like, what's going on? Nothing's standing still. Everything is moving and changing. And so when we try to anchor ourselves to something, it's like grasping at, you know, sand through your hands.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's highly philosophical, but it really does seem to be that way, that when we, anytime we, what are we doing? We're in a relationship or something that we see is starting to go wrong, we start to grasp more firmly for it. And the more that we grasp, the harder we try, the weirder things get, the harder it gets. And that's kind of just the nature of life. And so being able to let go, at least in some degree, is a really good idea.
All right. Well, there's about a million other things we could talk about, but I'm just going to have you back. you have this Matter and Psyche Symposium coming up. You want to tell people a little about that real quick?
Yeah, so the Matter and Psyche Symposium is going to be a fantastic event. It's a lot of really talented people. It's headlined with Graham Hancock and Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, both of which are in my book, The Quest for Gnosis. And really digging into all of the most interesting stuff. Basically, all the stuff we've been talking about tonight is the kind of stuff that you're going to hear from experts in their field. And I'm a newcomer to the symposium. I'm really excited to be there. But, you're going to hear a lot about psychology and new scientific discoveries and, cutting-edge philosophy that comes along with those sorts of things. And, integrations of all the good old stuff with new thought and where things are going and challenging dogmas, whether they come from religion or from science. And we're going to talk a lot about that. I'm certainly going to end up talking about the TED Talks debacle between Rupert Sheldrake and Graham Hancock, because they kind of ended up becoming these figureheads for the question of is our experience all entirely within our mind and material, or is there something more than the material mind?
Right.
And that discussion is going to be probably one of the benchmarks of it. But it's also going to be a really great time out in Joshua Tree. I think September 12th through the 14th. But you can go to matterpsyche.net and check it out and get all the details.
Okay.
And then
you said it was in September?
It's in September, yes.
Okay, and where is it?
It's in Joshua Tree,
which is where?
California.
Okay, California.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that because I've never been to Joshua Tree, but I hear it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. So you see a fantastic sunset and, all the great, obviously, the trees out there. There's a U2 album named Joshua Tree.
Right,
even.
Yeah.
So that's how you know it's got to be a cool place.
And you, your current book that's available, I assume, everywhere is The Quest for Gnosis.
Yes. You can find The Quest for Gnosis on GabrielDRoberts.com, or you can just go to Amazon or any other major digital outlet. You can go to a bookstore and ask for it. I've got ISBNs and all of that stuff. So you can virtually ask for it anywhere. It can be found on Kindle, on iTunes, everywhere.
Okay. And your next book is going to be a novel called The Hermit?
Yes. Yes. That's going to be really good. It's going to be a departure in many ways from the other books. I'm writing it as a novel primarily because I want to play with the situations. Talking about reality, the way that we see things, the way that you see a situation, you may not just be looking at the physical activity going on. For instance, you may see something in someone's eyes that tells you more than what they're saying. You're seeing emotions, you're seeing their own memories, you're seeing the future, you're seeing the past. And I want to be able to kind of play with those ideas as I'm talking about real-world experiences that did happen. So I'm writing it as a novel, kind of in the style that, I'm not going to say who I write like, but there are many classic novels that have kind of taken that idea. And they've written their life experiences as a novel because they wanted to be able to add nuances that a literal sort of clinical approach wouldn't be able to dictate.
Right. Okay.
It should be exciting. If the quest for gnosis is the theory, then the hermit is the practice, and it's completely unexpected.
Now, when do you plan on any ETA on when that's going to come out?
I think that's going to come out this fall or early winter. It depends on how things are going. I'm still in the writing process, but it's coming along quite nicely.
Okay. And your website?
GabrielDRoberts.com.
All right. And you've been in a few bands over your lifetime. And you said now you just kind of write some solo stuff?
Yeah. Every now and then I just write songs for fun. Or when I'm, you know, feeling a particular way. You know, I used to be in Christian rock bands. I was kind of my ministry in the early 2000s. And I learned, you know, I loved playing music and things like that. And I found over time that, you know, now that I'm in my mid-30s, the thing is not many people are interested in a brand new artist who is in their mid-30s. So it's much easier to write books. And since I wrote all of the lyrics, really it's just kind of a continuation of that same art form, just without the music. But I still love to write songs and make music, so I do.
All right, and we're going to hear something called A Million Miles. Anything you want to say about this?
It's just a recent song I wrote about, you know, longing for that other person that's far away. There it is. It's that desire begetting suffering.
All right. Anything else? Any last words before we go?
I'm thankful to be here, and I'd love to be back, and I hope everybody has enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. And I want to thank everyone for listening, and I'm definitely going to have you back. So here's A Million Miles from Gabriel Roberts. Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Say it's really good to be alone. You can find yourself and breathe. It's good to be unknown. Fading to the people on the street. But me, I've always known that what I want is a girl who'll sing for me. I haven't heard the tune, but somewhere right now she's singing for me. Just for me. She's singing just for me. She's singing just for me. And this longing is the picture that I paint.